Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Scott Linden here. Glad you could join me. Fascinating history lesson coming up today. We'll be on location at the National Conclave of the Club Epinal Breton, French Brittany to the rest of us, where we'll dig deep into the history from the guru in that subject matter. We'll also get an industry insider's perspective of the location and a few other tips on dog development and, hunting strategy, I'll call it. It's all coming up today on the Upland Nation podcast. We'll also go to you. I asked you on social media to describe your best hunt of the season, but I only let you use 10 words. So get ready to see what you and your friends thought about last season. And then a new feature this week, field test. Yeah, we're going to start looking at some of the new products out there that I think are relevant to you and me, and only stuff that I like and only stuff that I have tested literally in the field. It's all coming up right here on the Upland Nation podcast. Glad you could join me. It's made possible by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, Pointer Shotguns, Mid-Valley Clays and Shooting School, TruLock Choke Tubes, MidwayUSA.com, Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food, LandTrust.com, and ESPAmerica.com. Well, it's been an interesting week here at the home ranch. I talked recently about how little training drills throughout the day with your bird dog, kind of keep him on his toes, more mental stimulation than anything else. But here's one practical example of how it works. And then I flashed on another one today when I was working with Flick. Yeah, first thing in the morning, that was that the more of the interaction that you can create throughout the day, I think actually helps cement that bond between you and your dog. And, just the little things that I've noticed about him lately just reinforce that idea. But back to the training drills and how they pay off. We got two cats and they don't get along too well. And sometimes, they fight. So I had Flick on a little training drill doing a whoa in the living room, and here come the two cats who decide that they're going to fight right in front of him. And, you know, it gets kind of exciting. I mean, there's a lot of action. There's a lot of noise. And Flick looked. He kind of went up into the air a couple inches, slammed back down onto that whoa, and just watched the action. Luckily, it didn't last very long, and I was able to heal him away from that after the first stopped flying. I know it's never going to pay off in the field in quite the same way, but it will pay off. So think about doing a little bit more of that. And then, as you have, good job, you have thought about your last season, and when I asked you on social media, in 10 words or less to describe your best hunt of the season, here's what some of you had to say. James McConnell said in Michigan, his setter pointed 6 grouse in a row, and he finally connected on that 7th one. Mark Castile has a 112-year-old Lefevre 20 side-by-side, shot a double on quail in Georgia. Congratulations, Mark, for all of that. Here are the ones I love the most. Wyatt Allenson, my boy's first hunt. What an amazing memory. And it comes with a picture, too. Good job, everybody, on that. Seventh-month-old GSP retrieved a hand for Missy Correa. John Kozlowski says, my daughter and dog had fun. John, I bet you did, too, as a result of that. A lot of great trips with friends. Jack Gable had 3 dogs all steady to wing and shot. What does that feel like? Megan Garrett says she got 2 before the guys got any. Last day, everything fell into place. Yeah, I'll say it did. Sean Gliesane. I think, you know, I don't speak Gaelic, but I think I was, well, maybe I got the first name right. What a bag, too. There's pheasants. There's a duck. Let's see what else is in that thing. A couple small, probably teal. There's a mallard and a teal, three rooster pheasants, and then three Susies. You know what I mean. Anyway, good job, all of you. Some great stuff there. Christopher Cookston, shot a rooster, fell in the creek by GSP, retrieved it. Yeah, brr. I hope it was earlier in the season. My young dog solo hunting with a friend, fully cooperating, including a retrieve for Hugh Snyder. Good boy. Looks like a yellow lab from here. New Year's Eve flooding, washed out the roads, hunted the area alone. Jake and Oatner, isn't that cool? I hope you got there safely and didn't do anything silly on the way back and forth. John Simon had fun and made great memories. That sounds like a season full, not just one great hunt. Two woodcock and pheasants, bagged all of it with your German shorthair. John Pivetta, good job to you. Jay Gadosh, Lincoln and Clinton Youth Pheasant Hunts. It was the first two times I got to work my own dogs. Oh, and by the way, they lived up to all the bragging he'd done about them. Well, you got lucky on that one. It never works for me, Jay. Hey, you if you need some inspiration, go over to any of my Facebook or Instagram or Twitter pages and take a look at what people are sharing in this regard, among other things, because it is so inspiring, motivational. Now's the time to start getting psyched up about next season, and those are some great ways to do it. We're brought to you in part by ESPAmerica.com. Yeah, I'm using my new hearing protection devices in the field as well as at the range. They're custom fit, which is not a big deal. Anybody in the hearing industry can do that for you. And that's what makes them so comfortable. So learn more about what they have to offer at ESPAmerica.com. Remember, hearing loss is permanent and cumulative. So with every shot, you're going deaf unless you're protecting those precious cilia deep down in your ears. ESPAmerica.com. And if you're looking for a new shotgun, why don't you talk to an expert about it before you go too far and, say, pull the trigger, pardon the pun, on a gun that may or may not be the right one for you. Dave Fiedler at MidValleyClays.com. He and I have a special relationship. He consults to me on all sorts of shooting-related questions, including guns and how they work and why they work. Not only is he a champion sporting clay shooter, he is a bird hunter, avid bird hunter. So that's usually where every conversation starts. But the guy has offered my listeners something kind of unique. He wants to be your consultant in the shotgun world, too. Call him up, get the number at midvalleyclays.com. No matter what you're shopping for, ask him the few questions that need to be asked before you go too far along in your shotgun shopping adventure. Whether it's sub-gauges, side-by-side versus over and under versus a semi-automatic, Dave knows guns and hunting. And by the way, if you're looking for a hard-to-find gun, he probably has a line on it. Lucky enough here at the Club Epinal Breton National Conclave to have somebody who's been around basically from ground zero at this breed, the French Brittany breed. Fred Overby, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you, Scott. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Now, we're in Oklahoma, but that ain't an Oklahoma accent, is it?
No, I'm a Southwest Georgia boy, and I spend summers in Montana. I have a blessed life.
You do. And in fact, we could all aspire to that, I think. But you also spend a lot of time dealing with this fascinating breed, to most of us, a very unusual or uncommon breed. We could call it the French Brittany, or we can call it by the French name, Espagnol Breton. Describe how you got hooked on this breed.
Well, like a lot of other sportsmen in America that love the upland sport, I started out with pointers and setters, and lost the first two dogs, a pointer and a setter. And after losing a race for the U.S. Congress, I was looking for a pleasant diversion, and my then lady friend at the time told me to that maybe I should get a puppy, a Brittany puppy, and train it that fall because her parents had Brittanys. And so I started looking around, and the EB, or the French Brittany, had started to sort of rear its head in the American sporting circles by then. And I stumbled with blind luck to a guy in Jonesboro, Arkansas, who was one of the first really good breeders of hunting strain of French Brittanys here. And I got my first one in 1994. And that was 3 years before everything percolated to the point where we wanted to start, felt the need to start a club.
And what causes somebody to, I mean, we are lucky enough to have with us right now one of the folks who basically helped define the breed in the United States by forming a club for some reason. What were the origins? What's the backstory on this club?
That's a really good question, and it's pretty simple. In the 70s and 80s, some sportsmen who, for whatever reason, traveled internationally or had contacts or thought outside the box, had gotten to the point where they really wanted a dog that would hunt with them on foot. And they felt like some of the other breeds had evolved to where they were running bigger. Some had show factions. And there was just a feeling, I remember at the time, when all this was percolating, that there was a need for a close-working dog for the foot hunter. And so some of these dogs began to come back in to the United States, just one or two here imported from France because of Quebec and its connection to France and the French culture. There were also quite a few Bretons that made their way up to Quebec, and being close by and a neighbor, some of those dogs were eventually, their bloodlines made its way down into the United States. But at the start, we had a few French dogs, and they were catching on. People liked them. They were sort of intriguing to people because of the black and white and other colors variety, as we call it. We have black and whites, black and white tricolors, liver and white tricolors, whereas most American Brits are white and orange. Some liver, but the black and white caught the eye of a lot of American sportsmen that sort of in their mindset, I think, thought of them maybe as a little bit like a tailless Llewellyn setter or that sort of genre of dog. So they liked them, and you began to see pictures of them. And Dave Meisner, who was the editor of Pointing Dog Journal, had one named Gypsy, and he loved her, and he put her on the cover of I believe it was Gundog at the time, and that really gave a boost because they had about a 26,000 member or reader circulation at the time. That got them out there. So to get back to your question and try to answer it, what happened was they got popular and people started wanting more of them, but there weren't many here to breed. So a few folks began to reach out and to breed some to American Brittanys. And that, some good dogs came out of that. But in the mindset of people like me, we knew they were unique and really a separate breed as we viewed them. And so we wanted to keep them pure. So the goal was first to stop crossbreeding, or at least limit it, and to create a pure pool of EBs of European origin. All of them go back to France, but dogs came in here from Ireland that had gone to Ireland from France in the early days, Spain, and some of the other Western European countries. So we did that, and then the other motivations at the time were there was a real feeling that we wanted to keep the breed true to its origins and the culture that developed it in France. And the French do some unique things that we have followed suit with here in the U.S. We're actually doing them here at the Conclave in the way we field trial, the way we test our dogs for natural ability, the way we confirm them to see that they comply with the conformation of the breed. So that was another goal, was sort of keep them anchored to their French and European roots. And then a final real overriding factor when the club was started is the folks in it were all hunters, and they had little meat dogs. And some of them were pretty good looking, but some of them by our standards now were just nice hunting dogs and maybe not, you know, beautiful specimens of the breed. But we wanted to keep them gun dogs and hunting dogs. So to summarize, we wanted to stop crossbreeding. We wanted to keep the breed anchored to its culture and origins, and we wanted to keep them hunting dogs.
You know, I gave a talk a couple nights ago, and the first question I asked was, how many of you put your hands up if you're a hunter? And I think two people did not put their hands up, but everybody else did, and I knew I was in the right crowd.
Right.
What that does to me, and I think I heard you say it, that does it actually drive most of the other activities, whether it's breeding and testing or anything else? Is that the real motivator there?
Yeah, the EB was from its inception a hunting dog, a meat dog that was developed first to hunt woodcock in Brittany. And as their acumen became noticed by the French sportsmen prior to 1900, they formed the breed officially in 1907. They began to expand and hunt gray partridge and other game birds in Europe. And so they're pretty adaptable, pretty versatile. Maybe is not the precise word, but there is a versatile component to the EB. In the U.S., our people hunt them on every species of game bird, and I've yet to see one that with a few days to get acclimated to the terrain and the habitats of a particular bird, I've yet to find a game bird they can't handle with reasonable, you know, competence.
I remember talking to somebody yesterday who said, yeah, he'll even bring back a Canada goose. It won't be pretty, but he'll bring it back.
Right.
Because a good size, a greater Canada probably weighs as much as an EB.
Yeah. And our slogan is that there was a great leader in the French club, and he had coined a couple of phrases. One is a maximum of qualities and a minimum of volume. Gaston Pouchain, who was a great president of our breed in the 1950s and also a devoted hunter, coined that. So we are the smallest, and we like to think the best pointing breed.
Of course
for
you
the,
do.
For the money, by the pound.
By the pound. Well, describe the ancient origins of this breed. You mentioned that they became official, if you will, in the early 1900s, but it goes back. There's got to be some progenitor breeds and things like that.
Well, there's been a lot of research and some nice writing by Craig Kosich about the origins, and I would refer people to that. I'm a great fan and student of his work, but one thing he sidesteps a little bit is he doesn't tell so much the story of how the American and the French dogs split here in the U.S. We're the only country in the world that has a large population of Americanized Brittany's. So our situation in the U.S. here is a little bit unique. But the honest answer is we know some components of the origin. One of the stories that you hear consistently when you talk to the people that have who are the sons of people that were involved with the people that started the breed at the outset, is that there was good woodcock hunting down in France, and it was pretty cheap, and they had good numbers of birds. So a lot of the English guys would cross the channel and go down there to hunt during the when the woodcock were in. And in 1901, one thing happened in Great Britain was they passed the quarantine. So these guys would take their setters and springers and their blue blood bred British dogs down there to hunt. And then they found out they couldn't get them back. So they would have to leave them down there with a farmer or somebody in a village until they go back to hunt next fall. And well, of course, some unintended romances happened with the little French spaniels there in the countryside. But they made them into hunting dogs, and they took on some of the wonderful qualities of the little French spaniels, as well as the great pointing, retrieving attributes of the British pointing dogs. And so they began to then purposely breed them. And so that's part of how it started. There are some nice writings in some of the French sporting journals, if you go back far enough, that talk about that. Some of the other history going back is a little speculative. We lost it to antiquity because they just didn't write stuff down. We have a really good history since 1907 because we've got pedigrees and we had the French Breed Club, and they very well documented the history and the progress of the breed since then. The first one was shown in 1898. It was a tricolor dog named Pinkon Royale that was shown in a dog show over there in the open spaniel category. And eventually, after 1907, they of course had a category to exhibit them as Epagnol Bretons. And then our first ones, I may get my dates wrong here because my memory's slipping as I get older. But the first one, we had a dog female place in a field trial in 1898.
Wow.
Over there. That was the first one that we have recorded.
Now, when it comes to that kind of history, of course, you know, there's and who knows what else happened back there in Brittany when the dogs were left. But there was something about the ultimate the breed as it developed that was very important to hunters.
Yes.
What was it?
Well, I saw somebody, I was reading something lately, and it was one of the writings of one of the early guys that was involved with breedings here. He's dead now, but his name was David Follansbee. And he wrote about that, quote, special something about an EB. And he, I believe, I'll try to put it into words. One thing is that when they bred these British dogs to the little spaniels in the countryside, they inherited some of the great hunting qualities and conformation qualities of the British breeds that had been refined already for a long time, a couple hundred years or so probably. But they also inherited a bright eye, a curious mind, and an intense loyalty and love for their master. They really love their people, and they do. The EB does best in a home situation, or at least a situation where they're an integral part of the day-to-day goings-on of the family. They're intelligent, and they have some energy, and they need to sort of be busy, or they get a little bit bored sometimes. But I think loyalty to master, and that translates in the field. We were having a discussion the other night about the concept of obedience versus cooperation, and they're very cooperative, I think, naturally because of the unique qualities of their character.
I want half credit on that one because your Danish judge and I spent the day together yesterday, and we debated that difference all day.
Yes.
And there is a difference, and the cooperation aspect of it seems to be really important for most hunters in particular.
Absolutely.
It makes all the sense in the world. But you used the term bright eye. What do you mean by that?
Well, they have a lively, bright eye. They look at you. They make eye contact. You can sort of see them smiling sometimes in their eyes. They're, as a rule, very sweet. We rarely have any issues with aggression or improper social things with the with the EB. They're sort of happy little dogs.
And I see it in the field. They move as if they're happy. They're glad to be here, kind of a thing. And their movement, like their coupling, is compact.
Right.
How else would you describe their hunting style?
Well, one of the terms you will hear everybody around the world that's involved with this breed use is the term cob.
Yeah.
And cob means basically the body of the dog, not including the neck and the head, but the rest of the body forms almost a perfect square.
Right.
They should be ideally about as tall at the withers as they are from the front of the shoulder to the back of their tail. And that impacts their movement. And really good, well-bred ones move with a very unique gait, as we call it. They use it's a French dressage term called impulsion to move. But when an EB moves as opposed to an English setter, we don't see a lot of rear extension with the rear legs or a lot of reaching to the front. They move in sort of a tack, 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 very quick but efficient fashion. And that's what the judges are really looking at barrage, looking for in the barrages, because we want that trait to continue through in breeding. So I hope I answered
that. You did, and we watched that and saw that and compared, because some dogs do have a little bit more extension forward or backwards. What is the benefit to a dog that is moving correctly according to the breed standard in the field?
They hunt efficiently, and they can hunt all day, and not they're not a 30-minute or an hour dog. They're an all-day dog to go out and walk lots of miles and hopefully fill up a sack of birds, you know.
Well, Jake Bartels, who you know, and a trainer and hunter, and has seen a lot of other versatile breeds as well, also suggested that that gait allows them to move around and over obstacles slightly more efficiently.
Absolutely.
Have you seen that?
I would agree with that. They're very athletic. For instance, here in at Prairie Prime here for our national conclave field trials this year, he's got wonderful cover that Todd Ferris has developed, but it's thick and it's tall, and these are, you know, relatively small dogs in terms of comparison to the pointing breeds, and so they're very athletic. They can jump over that cover, and it's really neat to just watch them navigate the cover.
What is it you like most about this breed? Is it their ability to take you hunting and have a great day, or is it something else besides the spirit we talked about?
Well, it's a combination of things. They're easy to train.
Yeah.
On the spectrum of the training of the pointing breeds, they're a good dog for the amateur. They're a great dog for kids and for ladies who we're seeing enter the sport much more nowadays. So they really speak to a broad section of the public. But they're just really sweet, and they want to work for you, and they want to make you happy. And the thing they love in life most is hunting and pointing a bird and retrieving it and bringing it to you after you shoot it.
What a concept. A hunting dog that likes to hunt. Fred Overby, great, great history background. I'm Scott Linden. Fred is with the Club Epagnol Breton. That's the French Brittany Club here in the U.S. We're at the National Conclave at Prairie Prime near Wellston, Oklahoma. Come on out here sometime. Take a look at this place. I'm looking at the grounds through the windshield right now. It's incredible. Well-run organization. Thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
And thank you, Scott, for what you do for the pointing dog community here and around the world. And we appreciate greatly your support and showcasing a little bit about our breed.
Well, I hope you learned something from that great history lesson from Fred. Thanks, Fred, again for taking time out of the conclave and the field trial to spend some of it with us here. We've got a new product review coming up on our new field test segment, and more on the Epagnol Breton from Todd Ferris, my good friend over there at Prairie Prime. He'll offer up some hunting tips, how his operation works, so that you can become a better informed consumer, and then even some things on picking a dog. Right after these quick commercial messages, first from MidwayUSA.com. You know, I'm In fact, I think I just heard the UPS truck pull up. Hopefully he's bringing some of my new stuff from MidwayUSA.com. You know, I signed up for the emails and the text messaging, and I got 10% off my last order, which was my first order after I signed up. They've got just about anything you might need. So go to the website, stock up on target ammo, hunting ammo now when it's easier to find, and anything else you might be looking for this season. If you're a turkey hunter, they've got plenty for you. They've got a lot for us wing shooters, dog trainers, and a little bit of everything else. Put a big pile together, sign up for the email notifications, and you'll get 10% off your next order. It's all at MidwayUSA.com. And Fred Bohm over at SageAndBreaker.com says, all the stuff that you want is back in stock. Had a run on some of the consumables, the firearms grease and the CLP. It's all there and ready for you. Now's the time to stock up. Sign up for their email list and you will not miss out on future sales. And more importantly, when you need something, you'll hear about its availability. There are some new products in the works, including a more traditional rod and brush system if you want to clean your guns the old school way. It's all at sageandbreaker.com. Well, I'm lucky enough to be, I have the ringside seat to the Club Epinal Breton National Conclave, almost literally. We're sitting here in our motorhome studio watching the fields, and I can see orange dots in the background sometimes. We can hear some gunshots. So if you hear barking dogs, it's dogs that are involved in this big field trial, for lack of a better term, that's what I'll call it. And we couldn't have done it. I mean, this is all happening at a facility that is owned and run by Todd Ferris. Prairie Prime is the name of the organization that's hosting the field work here. Todd, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Tell me a little bit about, first off, how this is all going for you as one of the organizers.
Oh, it's going great. I mean, we're, of course, extremely busy. We're kind of chasing our tails every day. But as anybody knows, it's been involved with a field trial. But it's gone wonderful. We've had good weather for the most part. We had one rainy day, but the rain ended in the morning before the trial actually began. But today we're drying out, and it's been a great 3 days of field trials. And this one here is probably in the books about a quarter of the way done today so far.
You know, I would agree with everything you just said, and I would evaluate it slightly differently. We had a rainy day. We're in red dirt country, which means red mud when it rains. We only had to push out one car yesterday.
We're used to that here in Oklahoma, though, Scott.
Yeah, there you go. So here we are, and it's going well, and I'm impressed by so many aspects of it. Well, one of them is the grounds here at Prairie Prime. Describe what we're looking at through the windshield out there.
Well, what we're looking at here is a wing shooting club grounds, 640 acres total. And we have three courses. We have a course that's called St. Hubertus, one that's called Covey Rise, and one that's called Savon Rouge. And so we run a commercial hunt area operation here in Oklahoma designed for the gun dog owner. And we try to put a hunt together for the closest thing to a wild bird hunt that you can find anywhere. And we thought this would be great grounds to be able to hold the field trial on. So we're looking for good size covey rises. And the occasional rooster or two.
Yeah, just when you don't need it, actually.
Exactly.
But it is always a pleasant surprise to get a ringneck pheasant into the air when you're looking for bobwhite quail. Or the other fascinating aspect of your operation is you've introduced valley quail, California quail.
We have.
And they seem to be flourishing.
They are. Yeah, the California valley quail, we brought them in, and to my knowledge, we're the first people, in Oklahoma at least, that I brought them in. And We brought the eggs in from the state of Oregon, from their home range, and we incubated and brooded them and got them to this point. And we're going to release over 6,000 of them on the ranch this year. And they have. We release them in small batches, and the next thing we know, about a week later, we've got a covey of about 30 birds that have found each other. And they have been great, great birds, you know, to add to the ranch.
Well, if somebody's been to a hunting preserve, they probably hunted bobwhite quail, but not California quail.
Correct.
How would you describe the differences between the two? Beyond appearance, we can always look that up.
Right.
But they behave differently? They behave the same?
I think
what?
They behave differently. The California Valley quail, they're runners.
Yeah.
They will definitely run. They're almost like small pheasants. Yes, I know it. But and they tend to group up in larger coveys.
Really?
Yeah. And I think that's one reason they thrive so well is because they've got so much more protection.
Yeah.
I think their wing beat is faster. I think you get a faster flush with them, and then, you know, once they turn the afterburners on, they're gone.
Yeah,
they also like brush. They're very adept in woody structures. You know, if you find a bobwhite that gets up in trees or a branch or something, they almost look intoxicated trying to navigate the branches. But the valley quail, it's almost like they're a sparrow, you know, hopping around on the branches.
You know, not only do you operate this, we met a long time ago in basically a hunting context, if you want to call it that, and you're an avid hunter as well. But like the shoemaker's kids, your shoes are the last ones to get fixed.
Right.
You don't get to hunt near as much. What is it about the hunting side of things that you enjoy so much?
Oh, I just enjoy the lifestyle more than anything. I mean, I'm personally not a big field trialer or anything like that. I just enjoy the hunt. I enjoy the lifestyle. I enjoy the dogs. I enjoy being around people that also like to hunt.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to offer here at our wing shooting club to our clientele.
And when it comes down to it, is there any particular thing you see your members, for example, or other hunters doing that you would work on if it was you?
If it was me, I think the biggest thing I've learned from my clientele is when you're hunting, have fun.
Yeah.
It's all about fun. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you take what your dog's giving you that day and you just go out and enjoy being out in nature, enjoy the camaraderie of the people that you're with, and just have a blast. That's the number one thing.
If you could hunt anywhere, anytime, where would you go hunting?
After listening to you, probably going to Montana, going west, you know, I've got some bucket list hunts. You know, I'd like to go up to Canada for some bird hunts, and definitely Montana. And after you described Hell's Canyon to me, I probably don't have a flat enough belly to go to go accomplish that hunt.
Well, I can show you some slightly easier hunts in the Hell's Canyon League.
Okay. But hunting Chukar, Nevada would be a blast. I would definitely like to do that someday.
Yeah. So. What about your own dogs? That's how we first met, was talking about this breed and going out and making a couple TV shows with you guys.
Right.
What brought you to the Epagnol Breton?
Well, what I was looking for after I got into upland hunting, I figured out I need to get a dog. And I was looking for a versatile dog that was going to be great in the home. I was looking for a dog that was going to be a little bit smaller. And I came across the Epagnol Breton breed, and the rest is history. I got my first two within 2 years, got the bug, and here I am. I've got 10 of them now in a kennel, and they all get to hunt weekly at least, it's just been such an enjoyable experience for me. And of course, I got involved with the National Breed Club, which has been a great experience for me. I learned a lot from a lot of different people, a lot of younger people, and a lot of the old timers too.
You know, give me one of those, and I've met many of them, and some of the old-timers are full of great stories, mm-hmm. and some of the young-timers are, too, for that matter. But what was a lesson you might have picked up from, say, Fred or Larry or somebody like that?
Right. The genetics of the dog can be very important up front, and then the training of the dog is very important afterwards. So, you know, and that's kind of what I've done. Fred Overby from Georgia has been a big mentor to me. And he was one of the original members of the club and kind of our breed historian, if you will. And then R.L. Dalrymple, who's also from Oklahoma, was one of the first people that imported dogs over here. And he worked for the Noble Foundation here in Oklahoma for decades, and he has been vital in helping me with this ranch in terms of developing the cover and land management, things like that.
You know, let's help create the beginnings of a consumer's guide to finding a hunting preserve. Many of my followers have been or plan to be very soon shopping for a hunting experience that's maybe a little closer to home, a little more convenient, or they're looking for a place that we know has birds on it.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to kind of flip the switch and become a consumer of bird hunting preserves, but with your perspective as the owner and developer of one, what would you suggest we look for?
I would say look for people that are willing to put videos of their hunts on websites for them to take a look at.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're, you know, we're quail hunters here in Oklahoma more than anything. And when you start talking to quail hunters, they don't want to see one or two birds get up. I mean, they want to see covey rises like it was in the good old days. They want to see that covey rise get up. And that's a hard thing to accomplish with a preserve hunt.
Yeah.
But we've kind of nailed it. We've kind of figured that out. So my model was to get as close to what you might find at one of the Georgia quail plantations without all the frills. You know, we don't have a fancy clubhouse and lodge and things like that, but our grounds, our habitat, and our birds are, it's just a great experience.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. Those are the things that are important to virtually everybody, and it is working right here. And today, in particular, you also provided the correct amount of sunshine.
Correct. Yeah, it ended up being a nice day. I mean, today is a great upland bird hunting day for
now,
sure.
Now, if we want to learn more about your operation and what it looks like, so we can learn what good habitat looks like in a place like this. What's the website address for you?
It is www.prairieprime.com, and we're also on Facebook and Instagram at Prairie Prime LLC.
Great. Todd Ferris with Prairie Prime here in Oklahoma. The nearest town is Wellston, I think. I'm so turned around, I can't remember. But incredible event, the conclave for the Club Epinal Breton, French Brittany's, and it's going great. In large part due to the folks who are organizing it, that's you and a few others, key people have done an incredible job. Thanks for having the Upland Nation podcast as part of this whole event, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you, Scott, for being here.
Well, thanks again, Todd, for having me out there. Sure enjoyed getting to know everybody and watching these incredible dogs do their work in the field. We'll have more, including our new review of a product that I think might be worth your attention. That's coming up in our new field test segment after this word from LandTrust.com. Booking another trip or two for early season. I mentioned Montana. I may be somewhere else a little bit closer as well. LandTrust.com is your guide, your access to private ground that's well managed. Yeah, take the stress out of some of your long trips by knowing you have a place to go that's been managed carefully, where you and your dogs can enjoy yourselves and not have to share a field with anybody else. It's kind of like a VRBO for bird hunters. Take a look, poke around on LandTrust.com, see how it works, see how affordable it is. It's a DIY option, so you get basically the keys to the kingdom, and then it's all yours for the day. Yeah, sure, you may shoot a limit, but more importantly, you'll have the confidence to enjoy yourself, knowing you and your dog are the only folks on the place. Learn more at LandTrust.com. And shoot better with new chokes. I do. Okay, I still don't shoot well, but I shoot better because of TrueLok chokes. Learn more about the assortment and their lifetime warranty and satisfaction guarantee at TruLockChokes.com. T-R-U-L-O-C-K Chokes.com. They are always sending me emails when they have new products, sales, and promotions. For example, you know, you buy three choke tubes, you get a choke tube case for those. Lots of incentives at TruLockChokes.com. Better patterns, better shooting, bigger limits, all at TruLockChokes.com. I've been meaning to do this for quite a while. You know, I kind of mentioned in an offhand manner some of the stuff that I use and some of the gear that is sent my way that people want me to talk about. And I've decided at some point some of these things are of value to you as well. And so here we go with our first field test feature. This is a company that you may not have heard of called VTOMAN. That's spelled V-T-O-M-A-N. And if you want to learn more, they're at VTOMAN.com. Power stations have been around for a while, but these guys have decided that folks like you and me should be able to afford them as well. You know, they're basically a box, a giant battery, pretty heavy, about 40 pounds, but you can charge or run anything, especially with these newfangled VTOMANs. You can charge your dog collars real fast. I've done it at lunchtime in the field. You can do anything else that you would do with a 110 wall plug, if you will. You can charge your cell phone, your GPS. If you use a CPAP, you can plug that in at night and use it all night when you're camping. They got outlets for all sorts of USB cables, the 12 volt. You can even jumpstart your truck, among other things. You can recharge it fast. Yeah, it's a giant battery, so you got to recharge it via a wall plug, solar panel, or even in your car if you need to. I reviewed the 1,500-watt model, which was plenty for all of those uses. It weighs a little bit more than some of the competitors by 3 or 4 pounds, but you might be willing to put up with that because the price is considerably lower than some of those others, and they do offer a 2-year warranty. So if you want to save about 50% off those other guys and you want one of these to try in the field, head on over to VTOMAN.com. Check out your own VTOMAN. I keep mine in the back of my truck, fully charged, just in case. And this week, the field test was brought to you by PurinaProPlanSport.com. Yeah, I've talked about it before, but, you know, chemistry is not my forte, as they say in Great Britain. But I believe the nutritionists and the scientists at Purina. 30% protein, 20% fat is the right proportion for most hunting dogs most of the time. That will fuel their needs in the field and help them maintain lean muscle mass. Now, they've got a lot of formulas, a lot of protein sources, and they're all managed to provide omega-3 fatty acids and glucosamine to help support joint health and mobility all day and all through their lives. Learn more about all the choices at ProPlanSport.com. And then head for the field with your new pointer shotgun. Yeah, learn more about where you can find them and then shop the entire array at pointershotguns.com. Yeah, all of their shotguns have a 7-year warranty. Compare that to a lot of the other folks out there. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. And as I've said, now they're finally in the side-by-side market with all sorts of choices and, of course, over and unders and semi-automatics with a number of finishes. Nickel, bluing, Cerakote, case coloring. That 28-gauge case colored over and under is next on my list. Maybe yours too. Take a look at pointershotguns.com. Well, I thank Fred Overby and Todd Ferris for their participation during a very busy Club Epinal Breton conclave. Sure had a great time out there. And everybody else who was there and was so kind to me. I also thank you for listening and everybody who comments at the social platforms. You are what make this a great podcast. If you left a rating, I appreciate it. Well, most of the time. And of course, our sponsors, Sage and Breaker, Pointer Shotguns, Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food, ESP America Hearing Protection Devices, Mid Valley Clays, and Dave Fiedler, the new shotgun guru. Trulock Chokes, MidwayUSA.com, LandTrust.com, and if you want to carry on the conversation, start at FindBirdHuntingSpots.com. Thanks to everybody for your participation and for listening. I'm Scott Linden. See you at the range.